I hope all you constant listeners, you've got your Christmas and Hanukkah decorations up by now. That's the thing about this time of year. We seem like we just got done with Halloween. Then you spend the entire month of November raking leaves that seem like they're never going to end. Then you got Thanksgiving. Before you know it, you're thinking, if I don't get those decorations up soon, the holiday is going to come and go. So you better drag out the Christmas tree, dust off the menorah, hang those lights outside before it's too late. This is your favorite holiday Scrooge, Nick Deolius, bringing you tidings of episode 81 of the Far Middle Podcast. And as promised last episode, I'm going to invest the bulk of this time summarizing what happened when I was at beautiful Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio. Fun, enjoyable, action-packed day and a half, so we've got a lot to talk about. But before we get to all things Marietta, we do have a dedication decision to dispense with for episode 81. I'm going to follow the sound of the train, as in the sound of the night train, because episode 81 is dedicated to Dick Night Train Lane. Now, Night Train Lane is one of the top three hardest hitters in the history of the National Football League. You've got to put him there up with Dick Butkus as the top two. And then, you know, you can debate, you can pick your third across a host of different candidates, whether it's Ray Nitschke, Ronnie Lott, Jack Lambert, Steve Atwater, you pick. But Night Train summed up the philosophy of the great hard hitters on defense when he basically said he didn't tackle an opposing player by the legs because the player would fall forward and gain some ground when he would do so. Night Train figured it was much more efficient to tackle the opposing player up at the neck and stop him from gaining any additional ground so the defense could get off the field sooner and rest on the sideline. Now, an interesting thing about Night Train, he was born in Texas and he was abandoned as a newborn in a trash can. And someone heard him crying, and he was adopted by a local woman. Of course, he went on to attain great things. He retired as the second all-time interception leader and is somewhere, I think, to this day still in the top five for career interceptions. And he still holds the NFL record for interceptions in a rookie season. He set that back in 1952. He ended up finishing his playing career with the Detroit Lions. He started out with the Los Angeles Rams. And two other interesting things about Dick Lane. First, and how did he get the Night Train nickname? Well, early in his rookie year, during training camp, he would dance in the hallway of the dorm where the team was staying to the hit song in 1952, Night Train. And his teammate, which is another to-be Hall of Famer by the name of Tom Fears, was the one who was playing the record and gave him the nickname. And the second interesting detail about Night Train Lane was that he was married to Dinah Washington, who, of course, was the noted jazz singer. Lane served as her business manager while they were married, including up to her untimely death. So episode 81, coming at you like a Night Train Lane clothesline tackle. Let's start making connections for episode 81. So Night Train Lane, trains, mode of transportation. And many cities and towns are originally located based off of their proximity to natural forms of transportation, one of which, of course, being rivers. That was certainly the case for Marietta, Ohio. And when Marietta was founded along the banks of the Ohio River, basically other modes of transportation like rail followed subsequent to its founding, and the town was off and running. Now, Marietta is probably one of the most historically rich, significant towns that you will find, not just in Appalachia, but anywhere across the United States. And if you want a great sort of story that tells the history of Marietta, give a read to the great David McCullough, again, a Pittsburgh native who we've brought up, I think, in prior episodes of The Far Middle. But the late, great David McCullough wrote a book. One of the last books that he published was titled The Pioneers. And the subtitle of that book was The Heroic Story of the Settlers Who Brought the American Ideal West. Fascinating read. He goes to in-depth discussion of how the town of Marietta was founded. And it really goes back, interestingly, I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. It goes back to the Revolutionary War. And a lot of officers that served under General Washington when the war was successfully concluded were basically paid or compensated for their service in the form of land in the Northwest Territory. So basically this at the time, right, became what we called the Midwest, United States of Ohio, Indiana, etc. So they received these land grants. And most of these officers hailed from New England states. Once they got their land grants, they made the journey west. It was a very difficult journey. They had to go over the Alleghenies, and they ultimately landed down in the Ohio Valley and founded the town of Marietta. And if you go to the cemetery in Marietta, and by the way, the town itself is just a picture perfect postcard of what you think of when it comes to small towns in America. It's an awesome, awesome town. But there is a cemetery right in town in a residential neighborhood that is called the Mound Cemetery. And if you look over the gates of the cemetery, you quickly figure out why it's got the name that it does, because there's a gigantic mound of earth right in the middle of the cemetery, which is an ancient Native American burial ground. And when the original founders of the town from New England and from the Revolutionary War showed up in Marietta, when they passed away, they were buried basically around the Native American burial ground. So you've got this cemetery, which spans probably thousands of years of history from Native Americans going back who knows how long with the mound. And then around it, you've got headstones from the 1700s and the early 1800s that are basically the founders of the town who were buried there when they passed away. And an interesting thing about Marietta and Washington County, Ohio, where Marietta sits, Marietta and Washington County, Ohio, have more Revolutionary War officers that are buried there than anywhere else in the United States. And again, that's largely because of what happened with the founding of Marietta. Now, a key officer in the Revolutionary War and in the French and Indian War, who was one of the founders of the town of Marietta, was General Putnam. He is indeed buried in the Mound Cemetery. And as you might imagine, there's a street in Marietta named after Putnam. And if you walk down Putnam, it will quickly take you to Marietta College. And that's where I had spent a lot of time over the day and a half when I was there. And it really started off with a discussion with students across all different majors and disciplines one evening, just talking about career journeys and backstories and just engaging overall generally with the students themselves. So the types of things that that we talked about, one was sort of this shared legacy that is Appalachia, and talking about how their parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, we all basically share a similar story. Many coming here with nothing but their name and their work ethic, toiling away in industries, manufacturing, energy, et cetera, transportation, rail, right? And making a name for themselves, aspiring that their children and grandchildren go on to bigger and better things, entrenching themselves in the middle class, and then taking off beyond that. And that legacy, as awesome as it is and as great as it is, it comes with a responsibility for the individual, whether it's a student or whether it would be myself, anybody from the region, to basically leave it in better shape than we found it, to take it to the next level. And that we should feel that responsibility and take it seriously and drive towards achieving and excelling in a way where we're furthering that broader objective. So that was pretty cool to get a chance to talk about that and hear some of the feedback from the students on their individual stories of their families and how they view that responsibility as well. We also talked about career journeys and progressions. And, you know, here we talked about sort of the yin and the yang, I'll call it, of career realities. On one hand, you impact a tremendous amount of things in your career development. There's a lot of controllables that you have direct impact over, how hard you work, what you try to educate yourself with respect to achieve via education, what you might take advantage of when it comes to career opportunities, right? The quality of your work product. So on those controllables, it's a constant, continual effort. It's a lot of fun, but it's also, right, it's challenging. And that's the type of thing that that you need to look at over the long haul. We also talked about the flip side of this, which is there is also a component of randomness and chaos theory, so to speak, when it comes to career and professional development. And you go to anybody that's been in industry or in a career or in a profession for an extended period of time, and I use the example of myself over 30 years, inevitably, when they look back through their career journey, there are three, maybe four instances that popped up unexpectedly, by surprise, randomly, and the decisions when those opportunities popped up that you made sort of had an outsized impact on where you ended up in your career journey. And that they're not controllable, but you need to be ready for them. So this yin and yang of controlling what you can and staying focused on that, but also embracing, being comfortable with a bit of randomness in career journeys and taking advantage of it, seizing it when those opportunities present themselves, that's basically going to be what's to be expected if you're thinking about where your career is going to go as a young professional. So it's pretty cool because basically my view of it was I was giving them a message from 30 years into their future. You're going to be me in 30 years, And I can sort of tell you, looking into the future, what types of things you're going to encounter over that journey, at least generally, and to try to be ready for it. So that was a neat opportunity, I think. And then we also, you know, talked about a host of other issues and things that are out there with respect to education and the educational system. You know, I used the song title of a Johnny Cash tune, Worried Man. I said, I am a bit of a worried man when it comes to higher education, and basically just talked about how we're supposed to be the marketplace of ideas. It's become a bit of an iron curtain of suffocating ideas, where it's supposed to be a process where you learn how to think. It has now become a process where you're indoctrinated into what to think, how, you know, consent to consensus is a dangerous thing, at least in advancing and innovating. Like, you should challenge consensus, but all too often the system itself is looking for consent and conformity to consensus, and to have them be excited about and encouraged and comfortable with challenging consensus, that's a good thing. So we just talked about sort of the binary nature of how higher education should be, what it was, and what it's increasingly morphing into. And my take with that discussion with the students that evening, constant listeners, was two things. One, Marietta College is definitely an exception to the problem. I think it's doing a fine job as an institution with what you'd want to see with these issues when it comes to the educational journey of their, of its students. So that was really good to see. That came across not just that evening, but across the day and a half. And two, again, the students, the young adults that were in the room that evening, to me, they come across as a group of individuals that are going to be very well situated and focused, not just for their journey, but what they're going to be able to do and accomplish on behalf of wider economies and wider society. Now, the evening with these students and the discussion that ensued, it sort of fed right into and led to the following morning, where I had the opportunity to lecture to an ethical leadership class. And when that opportunity was presented originally, I saw the title of the course and I said, boy, that's something I gotta attend. It really stoked my interest. And the way I approached this opportunity with the class in ethical leadership was, I said, okay, at the beginning, class, we're gonna talk about baking a cake. And the cake we're gonna bake is that of how you build ethical leadership within a team or a company or an industry. And we're gonna approach this from the perspective of a recipe. What would be the steps, the ingredients in that recipe to be able to bake the cake of ethical leadership? So step one of the recipe, it's almost a prerequisite. It would be absolutely crucial and critical that you would be dealing with a team or a company or in an industry where the endeavor itself is absolutely critical and truly matters and is impactful to society. And fortunately, in the case of myself or the company that I work for, CNX Resources, or the energy industry in general, Appalachia, right, we have the opportunity to work in a truly noble endeavor and one that matters greatly to society. If we stop, if we can't do what we need to do on a regular basis, all economic activity, all of society ceases with us. So what we do truly matters. And that's incredibly important when discussing the components of ethical leadership, because it really turns you loose. It creates almost the dynamic, the incentive, the need, and the drive to come up with an ethical leadership formula. So that's step one of the recipe. Step two of the recipe would be making sure that the culture of the team that you're being part of or participating or leading on, that the culture embodies values that are broadcast so that everybody understands what they are, and that they resonate with the individual members of the team. And you've got to use those sort of values as decision filters. So we talked a little bit about the difference between values and priorities. We talked about values being constants. Values should not change because you're in a boom period within your company or industry, or you're in a bust period, or you're facing great times, or you're facing tough times, right? It should basically be something that remains constant over time. And for CNX Resources, the company that I work for, our values that we've settled upon are ownership and responsibility and excellence. And I talked a lot about how those are different from priorities. Priorities will change as time goes on, as conditions change. You should be changing and adjusting your priorities if you're going to be a good and effective leader. So priorities, they matter, right? They're important, but they're sort of subservient below the values. The values are more important. The values are static. They shouldn't change. the priorities, they should evolve, they should morph as conditions change. And with the values of responsibility, ownership, and excellence, we also talked a little bit about how you can spend a lot of time trying to define them with words on sheets of paper or on websites. And we certainly are guilty of that as well within the company that I work for. And I've spent time wordsmithing how you define excellence and how you define responsibility and ownership as much as anybody. But in the end, the most important test of what those values mean is not how you define them in words or how you talk about them. It's whether or not your decisions as a team, whether the decisions of leadership are consistent with those values. Those values almost serve as a filter on decision-making. And if you see decisions that are being made that can't be sort of morphed with or made consistent with the values, then oftentimes what you're going to be dealing with is talk versus walk, right? They're going to be different. What you're talking about on your values is not consistent with what you're walking on actions, and you certainly don't want that. That would be hypocritical. So, you know, set your values, recognize they don't change, define them, make sure everybody understands what they are, but make them come alive each and every day through your decision-making. Celebrate difficult decisions in terms of making them fit with the values as opportunities and touch points to basically reinforce the values themselves. And if you can do that, you'll quickly find that your culture will evolve to where you want it to be, and the team will evolve into the values that you want them to embody. Step three of the recipe, we talked about looking for symptoms of good culture that are consistent with your values. And again, you should see signs of these everywhere, every single day, across sort of longer periods of time, big decisions, small decisions. In fact, the smaller decisions are often the ones that are a better indicator of whether you're having symptoms of a good culture and decisions that are consistent with your values. And by the way, if you don't see that, again, that's a sign of inconsistency. That's a sign of basically talk being cheap versus, you know, these tangible actions that you're seeing with respect to leadership. And we also talked a little bit about how when you're setting ethical leadership, what that means for you or your company, you are inevitably going to find the individuals on the team, some are going to run to the values, into the culture, into your definition of ethical leadership. And, you know, those are the ones that obviously reinforce it and get you to where you want to be. And there may be other individuals, some of them very talented. These are not, you know, bad people per se. These are very talented. They're fine individuals, but their view of what ethical leadership or a good culture or desirable culture should be is different than what the view of the team is. And thus you're going to see them oftentimes exit. And that's something that actually should occur because you want the right individuals to fit the right values and fit within your culture. And then the last step we talked about was an interesting one too, which is if you're talking about ethical leadership and you're working in a company or on a team or within an industry that is truly noble and is very important and impactful to society, and you've got the right culture and values, then there's going to come a duty with it, a moral responsibility to advocate. And advocate in a way where you're rebutting mistruths, you're emphasizing, you know, why you are impactful, why the endeavor is a noble one. And that advocacy is something that is constant. You need to do that continually, intensely, eagerly. It's not comfortable all the time. It is additional effort and work. There's no doubt about it. But the good news is it does become very rewarding. It can be a lot of fun. And you can tailor it to the individual and the individual's desires and comfort level. So, you know, my version that I talked about to the class of advocacy is doing a podcast. We talked about the far middle. There's a lot of effort that goes into that on a weekly basis. Doesn't mean that every single employee within CNX Resources or on a team that is looking to exercise ethical leadership needs to publish a podcast every week. It can be very simple. It can be very different. And it can be nuanced and tailored to what the individual is comfortable with. And then, of course, you know, you can wrap all this recipe from step one through step four, I guess, of the baking the cake of ethical leadership. You can wrap all of it or ice it maybe with a layer of fun, because if you're going about this the right way, it should be a lot of fun. Yeah, challenging, and it can be stressful at times, but it is a lot of fun. So again, a cool opportunity to talk a little bit about a perspective of what ethical leadership means. A lot of back and forth Q&A within the students in the class, which was impressive considering this was an early morning class and coming up, 2 weeks before finals that the students were starting to get ready and getting a little bit stressed about finals. But again, another indication to me that that the young adults in Appalachia and the young adults at places and institutions like Marietta College, we are in good shape, Constant Listeners, when it comes to our next generation of leadership. We just need to make sure that a lot of the ancillary things around them and systems around them, et cetera, are there and designed in a way to serve them and sort of enhance their capabilities, you know, versus fighting against them or trying to nullify their potential. Now, the lecture in ethical leadership at Marietta College, that was quickly followed by the opportunity to provide a keynote address to the Economic Roundtable of the Ohio Valley, which is an organization that is fabulous. It's been around for, I think, around 40 years or just over 40 years, maybe just under 40 years. Represents different business leaders and civic leaders all across that area of the Ohio Valley. And we met in beautiful Vienna, West Virginia. And the topic of the speech was actually going back to a prior episode of The Far Middle that some of you Constant Listeners might recall. And what I did in that episode was I laid out six recommendations or prescriptions that if we followed those would instantly, you know, turbocharge the state of our overall economy and society, whether it's in Appalachia, the United States, or frankly across the world. And many of these six recommendations are themes that go right back to what's discussed in my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America, and all kinds of prior episodes of The Far Middle. So many of these will sound familiar to you. But of course, I'll just run through these quickly. The first one should not be a surprise, right? And this recommendation was a simple one, which was that the federal government adopt a balanced budget each and every year, a legitimate balanced budget, not one that's scored creatively using voodoo accounting or economics, but one legitimately where all the inflows from tax revenues, et cetera, are not exceeded by all the outflows. And if we don't do that, right, the current scary situation we've got with 30 plus trillion in debt and all the entitlement responsibilities on top of it, and those debt loads sitting at, what, over 120% of GDP, they're only going to get worse, and something bad is bound to happen unless we change our fiscal ways. And ironically, with this recommendation, we're not asking for anything, you know, over the top. We're just asking the Congress, A, does its job, and B, you know, they manage their finances, the finance of government, so to speak, the same way you do with your checkbook at home, and that that you do with your business and how things are handled with where you work. The second recommendation sort of ties to the first. Another common theme in Precipice, as well as The Far Middle with prior episodes, and that is with respect to the Fed and the Federal Reserve reining in its mission creep. Let's not worry about climate change and economic inequality and all these other things it's getting distracted with, as important as they are. But the job of the Fed, the primary job, is stable prices and setting interest rates to where they're at real levels versus inflation. Let's get that done first and successfully achieved. And once that's sort of successfully obtained, we can maybe turn our attention to bigger and better things that that I just mentioned. But right now, that is not, you know, the situation with the Fed and when it comes to monetary policy. Right now, we have grossly negative real interest rates, even with the recent hikes that the Fed has marched upon with the benchmark rates. We're still sitting at benchmark rates that are well, well below the inflation rate that we see across the economy. And when you've got negative real interest rates, that creates all kinds of distortions in the capital markets. It stokes and inflates all kinds of asset bubbles, stock market, bond market, collectibles, commodities, right? Everywhere you look, real estate, you have these asset bubbles. And this is bound to end, it must end, and it can end one of two ways. It can end by the Federal Reserve doing its job and raising interest rates to a point above inflation to create positive real interest rates. That might create some pain and some deflation of bubbles in the asset categories, but that's necessary medicine that we must take. Or the Fed can refuse to act or act too slowly, as it has, and then the market will basically call the bluff of the Fed. It will lose its credibility, and that deflating of bubbles and that correction that will occur will be much more violent, much more painful, and who knows where that ends. So it's going to end one way or the other, and the Fed would be well instructed to get on with its main primary mandate of stable prices and setting interest rates when we have real positive interest rates sooner rather than later. The third recommendation was one that none of you will be surprised by, which was eliminating, suspending, reversing all regulations and accords and treaties that are looking to tackle climate change, right? They've done tremendous amounts of damage across all kinds of economies all over the world, not just Appalachia, Texas, California, Boston and New England are coming to grips with these ill-advised climate policies. Europe and Ukraine, they're suffering through an epic crisis. The UK this past summer, fall, we're going to see more and more of these if we don't change our ways when it comes to these ill-advised climate policies. And unfortunately, we talked a lot about in the speech how despite these crises popping up and these data points, these symptoms arising everywhere you look that these climate policies are not working, it is almost creating a bit of a panic with the proponents of climate change policies, and they're demanding a doubling down of the so-called energy transition and a doubling down of the climate policies. That's a very ill-advised thing to do. The fourth recommendation that we came up with was in the arena of student debt forgiveness, in saying, look, there is definitely a wrong that has occurred here. Students and parents and taxpayers, you know, they've been ripped off by a bit of a racket when it comes to universities warranting that if you invest this ungodly amount of tuition and life savings into an educational journey, you're going to be left on the back end with a job that's going to basically provide a rate of return on that investment of time and dollars. That's simply not true in far too many instances. So there's definitely a wrong there that needs to be righted, but the answer, the right, making it right, is not at the expense of taxpayers. We should not be picking up the tab for $400 billion or so of student debt forgiveness. What should happen should follow classic tort theory in the law, which is the aggrieved should look to restitution from the entity that provided or did the wrong. And in this instance, that's the university itself. So if there's going to be student debt or student loan forgiveness for higher education, let's first tap university endowments to pay off that tab. And if we did that, not only would it follow classic and logical tort law theory, it would also sort of incite, catalyze reform from the higher education system. But today, of course, we're not seeing anything along those lines. And then I talked a little bit about the next recommendation, number five. I started out by saying, this is something that Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan both agreed with. And that's how many things can you find where those two presidents would agree on something? And that was the need to reform what's going on with public unions, particularly teachers' unions. And I talked a little bit about the Iron Triangle, which we've discussed in prior episodes. You got one corner of the public sector union, which is collecting dues from its workers. It's using those dues to fund political campaigns for a second corner of the triangle, which are politicians and judges that are elected. Those politicians and judges, once elected, they then appoint the third corner of the triangle, which is the administrator or bureaucrat who negotiates the contracts with the public unions. And you can see how this is a non-virtuous triangle that results in a lot of graft, and it comes at the expense of people left out of the triangle, and those stakeholders are parents and students and taxpayers. And that needs to stop. It's become much too big of an entity, and it's basically destroying the educational system. And you can see that manifest with competency rates for fourth graders and eighth graders, what's going on with college, as we've discussed. And again, we've talked about all these topics in prior episodes of the far middle. And then the last recommendation goes to social media, saying that's something that's impacting more and more of us every day. Social media entities are having it both ways. They enjoy the benefits of being a publisher, which means they're able to receive free speech protection and control the content that they place on their sites, much like a journalist or news organization would, but they're avoiding all the accountability aspects that come with being a publisher. And at the same time, they're also enjoying the benefits of being a platform, meaning they're not going to be responsible for content that's posted. But on the other hand, they don't have the accountability of being a platform where they're able to censor, basically, certain content providers that are going to end up on the platform. They can screen them out. So basically, they want all the advantages of each platform and publisher, and they want to shirk all of the responsibilities that come with each. And of course, you can't have it both ways. My recommendation would be to have each individual social media entity choose on their own but pick one. Do you want to be a publisher or do you want to be a platform? And you'll have the benefits, but you also have the responsibilities that come with either choice. So we've run a little bit over than what we typically run on this episode of The Far Middle, but it was just such an action-packed 2 days in Marietta, Ohio, and at Marietta College, that I just wanted to get as much of this as I could to you constant listeners. I'm going to post all of the different speeches and transcripts on the nickdeolias.com website, so give a look at that when you get a chance. You can go into more detail. And I wrapped the keynote speech by talking about Milton Friedman and tying all these six recommendations back to him. I said, you know, if you think about it, Milton Friedman, and I referenced a speech that he gave, a lecture, and the title of it was Why Government is the Problem. So I encourage you to give a look at that. If you want to track down a bunch of Milton Friedman content that's great, check out the Free to Choose Network on the internet, a fabulous basically resource that's provided on all things Milton Friedman. But his lecture on why government is the problem would have agreed, I think, very heavily with all six recommendations. And I juxtapose that with where government and where our leadership is today, with President Biden making the comment recently that Milton Friedman isn't running the show anymore. That is certainly the case, because if you look across those six recommendations, our leadership has basically taken the exact opposite approach to what I was recommending and what I would hope Milton Friedman would have recommended back in his day. So again, when it comes to fiscal responsibility of government, we continue to outspend drastically and grossly. When it comes to the Fed, it's not reining in its mission creep. We still have grossly negative real interest rates. When it comes to climate change policies, we are indeed doubling down. When it comes to student loan forgiveness, you saw what happened with the $400 billion or so that was unilaterally tried to be shoved through by the president without congressional approval. Public sector unions are as strong as ever. The Inflation Reduction Act was a gigantic gift to that special interest. And social media sites continue to have it both ways. So we're going in the wrong direction with respect to our leadership. 180 degrees opposite, not just from what I would recommend, but also what the great Milton Friedman would recommend. So thanks for tuning into episode 81. We'll be at you next week with episode 82.